Ryan Rose versus the State of Nevada. This is case number 53813. Yeah, of course. Okay, Ms. Thomas, are you ready to go?
I am, thank you. Mm-hmm. Good morning, Your Honors. Jonelle Thomas, appearing on behalf of Ryan Rose. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of the time for rebuttal argument.
Okay.
Ryan Rose, a young man in his early 20s, stands convicted of second-degree murder based on the accidental shooting of his girlfriend. While there is a sufficiency of the evidence for reason in support of this, my contention that his judgment should be reversed, and that issue is fully set forth in the brief. I'd like to focus on how it is that a jury in an accidental shooting case came to convict this young man of second-degree murder. While I welcome questions on any of the issues in the brief, it's not possible to cover them all. So I'd like to focus on what I think is the most glaring and obvious reason that this judgment must be reversed. And that concerns jury instruction number 28. The jury here was instructed, if you are satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that the shooting was accidental, without felonious intent and without occurring during the commission of an unlawful act, which in its consequences naturally tends to destroy the life of a human being, you must return a verdict of not guilty. That instruction is an aberration. That instruction is entirely contrary to case law from both the United States Supreme Court and this court, and any other court that's considered shifting the burden of proof onto the defendant. And in fact, in the brief, the state doesn't defend this instruction. They don't say this is a proper instruction on the law. They don't say here's a case supporting this instruction. Instead, all the state says is it's trial counsel's fault because trial counsel introduced an earlier version of this instruction and that this matter should be heard in post-conviction. There are three reasons why that response is incorrect. First of all, the instruction offered by defense counsel at trial ended at the, if you were satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that the shooting was accidental language, and you must return a verdict of not guilty. The state then added to that bad instruction the two other clauses, thereby alleviating its burden of proof as to those two clauses. Mr. Pertaro objected to that instruction, and pursuant to that objection, this issue is properly before this court. In addition, the district court has a sua sponte obligation to correctly instruct the jury, and the district court did not do so in this case. Finally, this court, if it wishes, may find ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law. There can be no strategic reason for offering a jury instruction which switches the burden of proof onto the defendant. There's no tactical reason. There's nothing that could be said during a post-conviction hearing that would justify the instruction that was given here. The fact is, it was a mistake. It was a mistake by defense counsel. It was a mistake added to by the state, and the district court erred in instructing the jury.
Counsel, you have stated that this wasn't asked for. The interpretation I have is it was, that language was put forth by defense counsel. I guess my question for you, even though I understand what you're articulating, is what as to the doctrine of invited error?
Your Honor, and we'll set forth the authority in the brief. no attorney would purposely walk in and ask for an instruction that switches the burden of proof unnecessarily.
But that's a, that is the fact before the court, so how do we deal with that?
As I said, this court can find that the state made it worse when it added the additional language.
Wasn't that offered in the defense's version of their proffered instruction also?
It was, and that was a mistake. And this court can find ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law, based upon the submission of an erroneous jury instruction that goes to the very heart of the case.
And the objection that was raised was not as to that particular clause. It was as to something else, if I understand it correctly.
Mr. Pataro did object to the state adding the two additional provisions. And so even if this court were to just consider this issue as to those two provisions, it would be properly before this court and it would mandate reversal. The one person who had nothing to do with this is Brian Rose, and he's the one serving the consequences of a second-degree murder conviction in the face of no evidence proving that he acted with malice in this case.
Ms. Thomas, assuming for the moment that the panel was inclined to agree with your argument that the instruction is in error and that the judge had a sui sponte obligation to correctly instruct the jury, what is your argument about harmless error? In looking at the closing arguments, it seems as though the state did not attempt to take advantage of the error in the instruction, but rather focused its argument on the fact that this death was simply not an accident. It was the product of second-degree murder.
Your Honor, and I don't have the exact page citation in front of me. The state also argued that even if this death was accidental, it was still second-degree murder. They argued that through the assault and the murder issue, which we'll discuss in a moment, they discussed the unlawful act of pointing a firearm, if it was an accident that happened during that. The state argued, even if it's an accident, it's murder. And I'll provide that citation during the rebuttal argument. The jury is also instructed that they're
not... But how does that argument take advantage of the error in the jury instruction?
I think there's not a requirement that the prosecutors rely upon erroneous jury instruction in order to obtain...
Well, no, I understand that. But in evaluating harmless error, we have to consider that.
Certainly.
If the state had stood up and said, Mr. Rose did nothing in this case to demonstrate to you that an accident occurred,
certainly
then it certainly makes it easier for the court or the panel to say, geez, I'm not so sure that this was harmless. It looks like that they took advantage of an error in the instruction, assuming the court found one.
I agree that would absolutely be a factor, but juries are also instructed that the arguments of counsel are just that, the arguments of counsel, and that they're to judge a case based upon the evidence in the instructions. And when you have an instruction that is clearly erroneous, clearly unconstitutional, it goes to the very heart of the issues in the case. Was this an accidental shooting? Was it done in the course of an assault? Was it done as part of the unlawful pointing of the firearm loaded or unloaded in another person? Those are the key issues in the case. And that instruction told that jury that unless Mr. Rose proved that those things did not happen to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, that they shouldn't return a verdict of not guilty.
Let me ask you this, though. I'm troubled by the waiver and forfeiture issue with respect to this language. Assume it's bad, the final clause in instruction number 28. That language is a verbatim reprise of what the defense asked for in this instruction. And I agree with your argument. Credit your argument that there could not have been a plausible reason to have done that, except perhaps to salt the record with error. I mean, what that's the policy ultimately for finding error to have been forfeited or waived. And that's the concern I have with respect to whether or not this issue was not just not preserved, but it was affirmatively introduced into the case ostensibly by the defense. That's what's troubling me about that.
I can understand that concern. I think if you look at this case as a whole, this case was going very well for the defense. Nearly every witness had something favorable to say in favor of Mr. Rose. maybe some attorneys, and I certainly don't think Mr. Quintero has any reputation for doing anything of the sort.
I don't either, and I hasten to add that. I don't think there was bad faith here. I'm just suggesting as a legal matter, at the outer fringes of this, why shouldn't we find forfeiture or waiver?
Even assuming that Mr. Quintero had done something, which I can't imagine he ever would, that too would be ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law. And especially under the record in this case, where everything is going in the defense favor, why he would purposely taint a case, and if you look at the Mazin case, which is where this court found ineffective assistance of counsel as a matter of law, there it was clear that the attorney was tainting the case. He was throwing that away. That was a horrible closing argument, and this court still found ineffective assistance of counsel. And I urge you, for each of those reasons here, there are so many other issues in this case.
Well, Ms. Thomas, there is one that is in several that are very interesting, but there's one that's very intriguing from an academic standpoint, and that's the merger issue. Could you address
that issue,
please?
In the Morris case in 1983, this court adopted the second-degree felony murder rule, and it did so not based upon the statutory language, but it found the California reasoning persuasive. And so it therefore makes particular sense that this court would continue not to be bound by the California courts, but to look at California as a source of persuasiveness as to this issue. And in California, this court took the same limiting approach that California took in saying it has to be an inherently dangerous felony. And most recently, after the trial in this matter, following this issue was preserved, that after the trial, the California Supreme Court came out with the Chen decision, which it said assault cannot serve as the basis for the predicate offense, that it merges with the homicide, that it's taking the second-degree felony murder rule too far to use an assault as the basis for a second-degree felony murder rule. And the analysis is set forth very well in the Chen decision. I would urge this court to follow
that rule.
But
what do you say in terms of the state's position that there was an amendment as to our law and restating assault by the legislature?
And certainly there are differences in the statutory language between us and California, both as to second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and assault. But I submit those are distinctions without differences. That we don't charge assault and murder within the same case based upon the same event. It's one continuous action. And because it's one continuous action, it's not like a felony murder robbery where the defendant's setting out to convict to do the separate act that's separately defined. The assault is the same action that leads to the killing, and therefore it should merge.
If the court credits your argument, and I know I'm cutting into your time, I'm sorry. If the court credits your argument about assault merging into the second-degree murder, was that error harmful?
Absolutely. And the state, in fact, does not argue that it's not. That, again, goes to the very essence of this case. If the state's arguing that an assault happened, that even if Brian didn't intend to kill his girlfriend, that in the course of the assault, a killing happened, and therefore he's guilty of second-degree felony murder. The jury found second-degree murder under these facts. I don't see how it could possibly be determined to be under reasonable doubt. If I may reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Morning, Ms. Welsh.
Pardon me?
Good morning.
Good morning, Justices. Sonia Jimenez with the Clark County District Attorney's Office represents the state of Nevada, the respondent here. What I want to start with talking about are the facts in this case. The defense is portrayed both here to Your Honors today as well as in their brief to the court that this was an accidental shooting. But in fact, there was substantial evidence presented at trial that this was not an accidental shooting but an intentional shooting. And I don't want the court to miss those facts and that evidence that was presented.
Counsel, we are very keenly aware of the facts. I guess to cut to the chase, how do you deal with the issue of burden shifting that has been put forth by defense?
Your Honor, this was an instruction that was proposed by the defense. It is an invited error that the defense proposed the language in their instruction. If the court finds that even though the defense introduced this instruction, that they're still going to find basically error in the case, that's basically putting the state in the position of a catch-22. On the one hand, we have an obligation, the court, the district court, the trial court has an obligation to present instructions that are supported by the evidence that support the defendant's theory of the case. And that was the defendant's theory of the case, is that if this was purely accidental, then the defendant was entitled to a verdict of not guilty. So on the one hand, the state and the court are obligated to let the defense have instructions that they're seeking that support their argument or their position. So if you put the position, the state and the position...
Not exactly. The court is required to give correct instructions.
Correct.
If the state tendered a reasonable doubt instruction, for example, that was not consistent with our statutory requirement, and the defense either purposefully, mistakenly agreed with it, and the court gave a reasonable doubt instruction that said that it's the defendant's burden to demonstrate reasonable doubt in the case, we shouldn't find error in that on the part of the district court?
Well, that's a distinction, because the reasonable doubt instruction is something that this court has specifically addressed and specifically said that there should not be any deviation from that instruction. And there would inherently be prejudice in giving a mistaken instruction on reasonable doubt, because that's the element.
But I guess the operative issue is, was that needed within instruction number 28 when you give a separate reasonable doubt instruction?
Isn't the law pretty clear that accident isn't the burden of the defense? Accident is something that's got to be shown by the prosecution, or the absence of it.
Well, I would agree with the court that the defense does not have the burden beyond a reasonable doubt of proving that this was accidental.
Mm-hmm. So you're agreeing that instruction number 28's final sentence was wrong?
I am agreeing with that, yes. What I would say to the court, however, is that beyond invited error, there was not prejudice to the defendant in this case. As the court already pointed out, this instruction was not argued by the state. The state did not say, hey, the defense didn't prove to you, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that this was an accident. That was in no way argued by the state. Additionally, the jury was correctly instructed on reasonable doubt. The jury was instructed on all the elements of the crime, including the crime of second-degree murder, which they ultimately found the defendant guilty of. They were instructed that they had to find that, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the state had proven the elements of second-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt. And they were also instructed that they had to read the instructions together as a whole without singling out any particular instruction.
Ms. Thomas reminded us of the instruction. It says argument is just that. It's argument, and that we are bound by, the jury is bound by the facts and the instructions. And if we have an improper instruction, what are we to do?
I think when you're looking at an analysis of plain error, which is what I believe the court should be using in this case, because the language that was proposed by the defense, that particular language was not objected to by the defense, they proposed it, it's relevant in looking to a plain error analysis, or was this harmless error, because the jury was not argued to the jury, it was not prejudiced by giving them this instruction, because they were adequately instructed on the elements of the crime, and they found that the state had met its burden in proving second-degree murder. One of the things that the defense argues is that the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the shooting was not accidental. But that's not correct. The modifications that were made to the instruction were to reflect the second-degree felony murder rule as it's been codified here in Nevada, to show that even if accidental, if it's committed in the prosecution of a felonious intent or an unlawful act that's inherently dangerous to life, then it is still second-degree murder.
But if assault merges with the second-degree murder, that argument doesn't fly, correct?
That would be correct, Your Honor, but I would say that there is little to no reason for this court to adopt California Murders Doctrine. And if I can move to that issue, I'll explain kind of what the state's position is on that. In People v. Chun, the California Supreme Court went through basically an extensive analysis of how the Murder Doctrine came about in California. And they had quite a few problems with their merger doctrine. Their cases, the courts of appeals were split. They had several different cases using different analyses. Some wanted to look at the elements of the crime. Some wanted to look at the facts of the crime. And they were all over the place. So in People v. Chun, the California Supreme Court tried to go through and basically put forth one standard for their merger doctrine. But the main distinction and the reason that this court should not adopt the court's reasoning in Chun is that they do not have the same statute in California that we have here. Our legislature has expressly indicated that in Nevada, we find conduct that is felonious in nature and also inherently dangerous an unlawful acts which are inherently dangerous, something that we want to discourage our citizenry from participating in because of the great risk of harm or death in being part of that activity. And so the legislature has made that distinction. This court has noted that that's something important to look at in Contreras v. State in addressing first-degree murder. For quite some time, California also found the merger doctrine to apply in first-degree murder where there was a burglary that the underlying intent of the burglary was assault. And they found that that meant that if that was the case, merger applied and that they wouldn't be able to use the burglary as part of first-degree felony murder. This court expressly rejected that argument because we had a statute on point where felonies were specifically enumerated by the legislature. And I would argue that that finality that...
Well, that wasn't the only reason Contreras came out the way it did. It also rejected the reasoning in California and adopted the approach taken in New York. But in doing so, it necessarily begs the question that when the predicate felony is assault, that we might follow New York. And at least under People versus Moran, New York treats assault differently than burglary. Now it would seem that we should deviate from the jurisprudence from New York, according to your contention. I'm a little bit concerned that if you trace the jurisprudence on this subject and we were to decide this case and say assault is not or is a predicate felony, we've now deviated from the jurisdiction that we said we were going to follow. This is troubling to me. Can you address why we should do so and ignore the reasoning in People versus Moran?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that although that was something that the court in Contreras looked to in making their decision, I don't think that that their analysis is ultimately ends up being binding on this court. In preparing for the argument, I was looking through some of the recent orders that the court has issued, and the court issued, in fact, a recent order on this issue, and it noted in a footnote, cited to a California case, People v. Farley, where California itself has actually backed down from their merger doctrine in first-degree murder. And their rationale in People v. Farley and backing down from that was the same as the court used in Contreras, and they basically cited favorably to Contreras and said that there's not a reason to, when the legislature has specifically enumerated these felonies, then the merger doctrine shouldn't apply because the legislature has made clear its intent. In California, they don't have the same statute in second-degree murder as we do here. So in our jurisdiction, the legislature has expressed its intention as far as what conduct it is making second-degree murder. And that's why I think this court should follow that, because the Nevada legislature, and representing the people of Nevada, has said that this conduct is so concerning that it's something we should find criminal and second-degree murder. And really what it is essentially a subset of implied malice. Implied malice is reckless endangerment and abandoned and malignant heart. It doesn't have to be an unlawful act in order to find implied malice in second-degree murder, but our legislature has gone through and said, look, we're going to limit it. We're going to focus on, not limit implied malice, but limit this particular issue to focus on felonies that are inherently dangerous or that have a reasonably foreseeable possibility of death. And I think
counsel, as to that specifically, defense has stated that fear of immediate bodily harm falls short of inherently dangerous. How do you respond to that?
This court has traditionally looked at the actual facts underlying the conduct in looking at second-degree felony murder. For example, in Noonan v. State, in the case of child abuse, the court said, look, putting a child, leaving a child in a bath for 20 to 25 minutes unsupervised, that's inherently dangerous. In State v. Morris, where they initially recognized second-degree felony murder in the statute, they looked at the sale of drugs, and they said, look, the sale involved lethal amounts of drugs. It involved the drugs were ingested in the presence of the seller, and so based on that, looking at those facts, this is inherently dangerous. Here, the conduct of
Go ahead and finish your thought.
The conduct of the defendant here is absolutely inherently dangerous. It is reasonably foreseeable that when you point a loaded firearm at somebody and when you pull the trigger, which he had to have done because that trigger pull was such a great weight, it was not something that just tapping the trigger or brushing against it would have made that gun go off. When you point that gun at somebody, a loaded firearm, yes, it's reasonably foreseeable that someone is going to be substantially injured or killed by that firearm. That is the purpose of a gun. That is why there are such extreme rules about how to handle a gun. You never point a gun at anyone. Because of the great danger of that a firearm can produce. And so absolutely, in looking at the underlying facts and the conduct of the defendant in this case, he certainly created a great risk of harm. It was reasonably foreseeable that the victim in this case, Jackie Watkins, was going to be shot and killed, as in fact she was, when he pointed a loaded firearm at her and pulled the trigger.
Ms. Jimenez, I'd like to take you back to the question I asked about People versus Moran. I appreciated your input and your observations about assault and the approach that the California court has taken, but I didn't hear you address the reasoning that was contained in Moran. And what I'm concerned about, the question I have, is whether by not viewing assault as merged, we in effect take ourselves to a point where no shooting homicide would ever be a manslaughter, which is essentially what Moran says. Again, could you comment specifically on the New York court's approach in that case?
Sure, I absolutely don't think that would be the result of this court ruling in favor of what I'm arguing here. I don't think it would make every shooting death something other than involuntary manslaughter. I think there are many factual situations of a shooting where it wouldn't arise to second-degree murder, where there would not be this inherently reckless dangerousness. For example, somebody perhaps in their home, in a room, empty by themselves, cleaning their firearm, following the appropriate precautions, and as they're cleaning the firearm, the gun goes off, it goes through a wall, and shoots someone who happens to be passing by on the street. I would say that that would not arise to a second-degree felony murder because it's not conduct that is inherently dangerous or reasonably foreseeable to result in death. So I don't think that that would be the result of this court's ruling. And I think that the reason that the court has looked at the facts is because it does depend on the facts. When you're looking at second-degree felony murder, the reason that that is dangerous is because of the conduct that creates the danger. This isn't an assault with deadly weapon that occurs because I'm coming to kill someone. I walk up to them, I point the gun at their face, and I shoot at them with the intention of killing them, and they die. Well, sure, there's an assault with deadly weapon that's included within that murder. But there are also assault with deadly weapons that are not included in murder, and that's the conduct that the legislature is attempting to criminalize and to find to be second-degree murder. And I think that the court should follow what the legislature's intention was. I don't think that it makes every shooting suddenly a second-degree felony murder. I think that the reason that it's easy to come to that conclusion is because, sure, having a firearm and handling a firearm can be dangerous, and in many circumstances, it is a dangerous situation, but that doesn't mean that in every situation that's the case, in every shooting case, that it's a second-degree felony murder. And I think that where the legislature has recognized that dangerousness and wants to criminalize that behavior, that's something that the court should follow and adhere to.
Could you address one other question? It seems to, for me at least, it relates to the subject we're talking about. My understanding is that the felony murder rule was described in the involuntary manslaughter instruction, but was not contained in the second-degree murder instruction. And yet the argument, closing argument of the state, was to include as a basis for second-degree murder, felony murder. I'm a little bit concerned about utilizing the felony murder rule, which has been given to the jury in the context of involuntary manslaughter, but omitted from the second-degree murder instruction.
I'm sorry, you're saying that you're concerned about having the language within that same instruction and not also including it in the second-degree murder
That's
instruction?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that the jury was completely and adequately instructed on the elements of the crime. The instruction came directly from the statute, and it was supplemented by the language from Morris that says that with the felonious intent, it also has to be inherently dangerous. There also has to be a causal connection. It was supplemented by that, and that was the most logical place to put that instruction. The jury, as I noted before, is instructed that it reads all of the instructions together. I don't think taking that same language and including it with second-degree murder would have made a difference because it's still an appropriate instruction and to be given to the jury and is based on the case law and statute that this court and the legislature have put forward. So I think that if the legislative put it there because that's where it makes sense, and I think it makes sense in the instructions. That said, you could have put it with the second-degree murder instruction, but I think, as I recall, the involuntary manslaughter came right after the murder instructions. That's the normal progression, and I think that that was
there was nothing inappropriate or misleading to the jury about that.
Okay, any other questions from the panel? Thank you, Ms. Jimenez.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Thomas?
Thank you. If I may briefly, at the Record on Appeal in Volume 2 of page 10, there's a long argument that the last provision is from the prosecutor during closing argument. Yes, that's why the law has stated this as it did, has taken these facts out of involuntary manslaughter and making it murder, has said that even if it's an accident, even if it happens during the unlawful act or during the prosecution of a felonious intent, that is murder. And that is not an accidental homicide, it's murder, second-degree murder, and that's what the instruction tells you. When you have that argument coupled with the instruction here, the prejudice is exacerbated. The prosecutor is arguing, even if it's an accident, it's second-degree murder because it happened with a gun. And this gets to a critical issue, which you touched upon, Justice Hardesty, which is we can't have strict liability for gun accidents. And the instructions given here, the argument given here, the whole theory of liability here provides for such approach. Under the Second Amendment, as we now know applies to the states under Nevada's Constitution, people are entitled to have firearms. There's no obligation that they keep them in the trunk of their car. There's no obligation that they immediately put them in a drawer when they arrive at a house full of adults. The fact is, accidents are going to happen, and if those accidents are going to result in convictions for second-degree murder, then that cannot be reconciled with the Second Amendment right to own arms.
Are you posing that as an absolute, or it depends?
I think you have to prove malice, which is a subjective standard, not an objective standard. It's not, he didn't properly follow the rules of some gun training that we don't require in this state unless you have a concealed weapon permit. It's a subjective standard. Did this man mean to harm his girlfriend that night? And there is no evidence that would suggest that he did. I'm asking this court to find insufficient evidence of malice. I think on this record there is no evidence of malice in this case. The second-degree murder conviction should be vacated, and this should be remanded for a trial on involuntary manslaughter. In the alternative, I would ask for a new trial with instructions as to how to properly instruct the jury under the murder doctrine. The People v. Farley case was not raised in the brief. There's no Rule 28J letter. I'm not prepared to address it if the court would like supplemental briefing. I am happy to do it, but otherwise I would ask this court to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
All right, counsel, we appreciate your advocacy in your briefs and this morning in oral argument. Two talented lawyers doing an outstanding job. We appreciate the input. The case will stand submitted.